Well, good evening. And first, it's a very great pleasure for me to be here tonight. And so first, I want to thank David for this very kind introduction. And oh, yes, I'm sorry. And I want also to thank Derek and Beth, who is not here, and Marsha, who actually have found me and through which I have found this wonderful opportunity to be here at KITP talking to you tonight. And now I have to start this talk. So we decided to call it the interplay of art and physics, and I'm going to remember who I am, how art and physics relate, and talk about my work and the fields on paper show. So actually, some people have never known I was in Santa Barbara for 20 years, but I was. And actually, I was here and mostly doing my work and staying in my studio. And suddenly, a few people who were part of the art community, like Hélène Levasseur and a group of students at Adult Ed, who were all working on printmaking, actually found me. And I started to show my work in Santa Barbara. Before, I was only showing outside. I was showing mostly in venues relating with actually with computers. So it was very interesting for me to open this way. And after a few shows here, I happened to become artist in residence at KITP, which in a way surprised me as much as everybody else, because certainly I'm not a physicist. And I put here a few notes and to actually testify of a long-term interest on theoretical physics, because when I was 19, I read a book which actually is on David Gross' shelves, and this was more than flashback. But I, you know, fate chose otherwise, and I didn't go into physics. But I've always been very attached to astronomy and to galactic dynamics, and actually, in my first years in Santa Barbara, I got very interested in galactic dynamics model that were developed by Toomer and Toomer. And I have found, actually my son has found in a book, one sheet of some graphics which I did on a very small HP 45 many years ago. So anyway, being here, artists in residence at KITP raise several issues that I have to resolve between the relation between art and physics, so that I can actually really find out who I am and what I'm doing here. So first, we're going to talk about art and physics. Starting this investigation on the relationship of art and physics, I had to consider the Art, Image and Science program, which KITP has actually published on their website, and decided to get into the details of this talk to help participate in the shaping of the Artist in Residence program, to help to contribute into this Art, Image and Science program that is here, but also in a more selfish way, to find new sources of inspiration, to get closer to certain forms of truth which physicists and artists, as David mentioned, are together looking after, and to increase the breadth and the depth of my own work. And I, knowing very well how I work, I see the potential for incredible improvements of what I do while I am here. So I'm very excited by the whole thing. Then, when I started making searches on the web, on Google, and libraries, and discovered that the relationship of art and physics is actually a very active field, and that an incredible amount of books and courses in universities and and articles on the web exist. And I will provide on to KITP a list of references that we will publish so that you can actually access them. So this is how I will develop this talk: a preliminary warning, similarities and differences between art and physics, a web of interrelations between art and physics, a very short history of the interplay of art and physics, and I will just, you know, skip on milestones, because otherwise the whole history of our civilization that we will have to get through tonight in a few minutes, which is totally impossible. And actually, I thought of giving some examples, but for reasons which I will explain, I will probably skip that, because there is so much information which has been published on those subjects by people who have a deep understanding of it that I could not acquire in the few weeks that I had to prepare the talk, that I prefer not to talk too much about what I do not know, so I will send you to the right sources. And then we'll say about where we are now, and I will mention a recent controversy opened by David Hockney. So first, I must say that I'm not an historian. Critical history is not my field. I have noticed that in all those research which are published, very few seems to be published by either artists or physicists, which is also interesting. And I have only experimented slightly with what this research are concentrating on, because perspective and cubism and fourth dimension and science fiction and other things are not really part of my concern and interest. So similarities and difference, how we perceive and understand our world. Actually, we do that with our senses. But we need a path of knowledge to actually incorporate what our senses can feel. And for that, we either use our imagination or we use our intelligence. And both art and physics actually are aiming at this, and we try to find the rules of this world and in these different ways. To define art and physics is actually very difficult, and I think we all have our own definitions of that. And I will not expand too much on the subject, but I will actually do a definition which I found in the literature, which I really liked, and which was saying that children at play and artists and scientists at work actually create reality. And I think this is very important, because reality exists, it is there. Even if there was no artist and if there was no physicist, the cosmos would be there, and matter would be there, and the atmosphere and the nice color of the sunsets and the nice colors of the sea and would all be there, but there would be no conscience of it that would exist. What actually make a reality of all of that is the understanding that we can bring to it. So the perception of reality is really what actually lighten up our lives, and it's coming both from, in my view, of science and art, and they are part of our endeavor. What is interesting also is that physics and art are using a lot of common word, and physicists and artists will talk of volume, of space, of mass, of force, of light, of color, tension, etc., etc. They will study the density of things, they will look for elegance, for symmetry, for beauty, for aesthetics. So there are many, many notions in common, and it's interesting to understand why. Also, artists and physicists study space and time. They deal with illusion and reality. They deal with chaos and order. And physicists and artists can be at the avant-garde of their own fields. And also, there is the zeitgeist, which makes that certain people all at the same time study or are interested in something like cubism or strings, I guess. So there is a web of interrelations between art and physics. And first there is the art of physics, and I will let David to talk about that. And there is art by physicists. We have mentioned, you know, Einstein and Feynman were very well talented musicians, both of them. Feynman was doing drawings, he took drawing classes, and I was hoping to show a portrait of Dirac by Feynman, but then I forgot to include it in my slides. And physics by artists. An example mentioned by David was Leonardo da Vinci, but interestingly, it has been found by mathematicians and physicists looking at the work of Jackson Pollock that when he was with his brushes and cans dipping and dripping paint on canvas by just running around them and doing whatever he liked to do, he actually was able to attain patterns which had an incredible fractal dimension of almost 2. And when he was asked how he could actually be so similar to nature, he simply said, "I am nature," which was very modest of his part, but this was actually the truth. So then there is a juxtaposition of art and physics, to me, in all the world of art for physics, which is the art of our senses and the art of our sensors. And I found, for instance, these 3 images that have been brought by the Kobe satellite as very, very beautiful pieces. And they have not been conceived as art, but they are. They are by their own beauty, and they are also by the depths of information that we can expect to draw from them, and which are probably a key to reveal very, very substantial events that are part of our world. Then there is also art not for physics, but from physics, which is all the art that physicists will actually produce, either to ask for grants or to explain their results or to publish in magazines. And actually, some of this art is also very interesting. Then there is art using physics. I've tried some time to do that. Artists have been using wind, water, magnets, and I've been using nature as a driving force. They've used pendulum and gravity, and this is also what Jackson Pollock was doing when he was dripping paint. And then it's also possible to use physics laws as a guiding hand for art, and everybody who draws parabolas and trajectories and photographs, fireworks and so forth is actually confronted with nature and with its rules. Then, of course, at some point it's difficult to place a limit to what art is. Art can be in an image, but an image can also be just a piece of information that exists for itself. So between art and visualization, there is a whole realm that will really depend on personal taste and ideas and circumstances. So I will not expand into that. But here I'm giving one image which was provided to me by a member of the pattern seminar by Eshel Ben Jacob, which actually is art perceived by people, but not done by people. This is actually a colony of bacteria, and it has grown that way. And it is very interesting that it is perceived by art, because the natural growth of this colony of bacteria correspond to an image that we are really familiar with, and which is really perceived by our senses in a very positive way. Here I have something else which is coming from Eberhard Bodenschatz, and he was a research that was started here in 91 in Santa Barbara, actually in the physics department, and which shows Rayleigh structures in gases, and which creates this incredible maze of spirals which are rotating and living by themselves. And it's very interesting to me, because I have done work that really looks like that, and I did it for aesthetical reasons, and I did it mathematically, and it's about the same thing, so it's very surprising to me. And that's an example of art done by physicists, And it brings me back to tumor and tumor and to galactic dynamics. And it shows the interaction of two galaxies as they are being simulated on a computer. So now to come back to shortly on the history of this interplay of art and physics, it is interesting to see that across the history of our civilization, there has been parallels between the development of art and physics. The example of the classic world is well known, and the Greeks knew about light, they knew about an heliocentric solar system, and they had understood perspective, and they had, of course, wonderful art. And both art and physics seems to have developed hand in hand for several centuries in Greece. But then the Roman Empire developed over the antique world, and as it probably fostered the development of Christianity. And Christianity was no longer interested in understanding the world, because the only thing that people had to do was to believe in the Savior, and suddenly it became irrelevant to understand the world. And all of a sudden, there was a great destruction of all the civilizations, art and science that had been developed before. And the notion of time, which the Greek had developed, was actually squashed. It was discovered that time had existed only for 5,000 years, just counting generations into the Bible. And that after the day of the last judgment, time would stop and we would just freeze into eternity. And as a result, physics knowledge disappeared completely. And the world of art forgot about many of its colors and forgot about perspective. And the relation of people with the world was really came to a stop for a very long period. And this lasted from almost 15 centuries. Then we had the Renaissance happened. And it happened, the first sign of it happening seems to have been paintings by Giotto, who was in Italy at the very early time and actually developed perspective in his images. And perspective had disappeared, and slowly it came back. It came back and it was analyzed about a century later in the 14th century, and a theory of perspective was established. Another painter, I think that Della Francesca, came in and developed a much finer understanding of colors, of light. Shadows started to appear in his paintings. And very, very quickly, art developed and produced this magnificent Italian art. At the same time, Copernic came back to the idea of a non-Ptolemaic solar system and of an heliocentric system. And Tycho Brahe and Kepler succeeded in understanding how the solar system was working, and rediscovered the notion of ellipse, which actually had disappeared from art for something like 15 centuries. And then came Newton. When Newton came, it was a complete revolution, and the classical world and the classical era developed in Europe. And it became obvious that rational thought was actually the only guide that would direct the work and the quest of scientists and of artists. It is interesting, by the way, to note that Newton, as well as being a remarkable physicist, wrote several thousand pages on a subject dealing with astrology and magic systems, which actually I discovered during this research, and it's something that nobody generally talks about. But what is interesting is that at that point, progress were made very rapidly, but progress in art and sciences. But near the mid of the 19th century, a crisis opened, and the crisis was going to completely transform in a matter of 50 years, at the same time, art and physics. Manet was a painter who started actually a revolt against the art habits and changed perspective and changed colors and changed subject in his work. About at the same time that in geometry, Riemann and his predecessors started to beat against Euclidean principles that had been prevalent for many, many centuries. And at the same time as mathematicians and physicists started to have doubt on this very solid universe of reason, other artists came and decided that light was not as we thought, and the first big changes in light were brought by the concept of Cézanne, and slowly we arrive at the dawn of the 20th century, when Einstein published his work on relativity. About at the same time that artists like Braque and Picasso actually revolutionized art by totally abandoning the typical ideal of representation and broke all the rules of perspective and of time. And since that time, everything evolved very rapidly in a kind of chaos which we can now witness, and which is happening in art, and some say almost also in physics, because it seems that some of the research which are done now, for instance, in strings, I've seen that in an article in the New York Times a few days ago, seems to diverge completely out of our expectations. So I've not been making this obvious enough, but the claim is that visionary art has often been the precursor of visionary physics. And Giotto is mentioned for that, and works on light, which has happened, and research on light, which has happened from artists way before Newton addressed the subject, seems to be the reasons mentioned for that. What it seems to me today is that physics seems much better organized to actually move forward than art. And art will have a very big problem, or artists will have a very big problem to adjust to the development in physics and adjust to the development in our knowledge, because artists keep being attached to a very narrow forms, to two-dimensional canvas and paper, to three-dimensional sculptures, when physicists are now discussing spaces which have 10 or 11 dimensions. And to be able to go through the process of making this new world accessible to most of us seems to be very difficult in the absence of proper training for artists. There is no place, probably, but here, where artists can actually get close to physicists, to have the mathematics required, to have the understanding in topology that will become necessary. There is nothing like that in the formation, you know, and the education of artists. And probably this is something that should be researched. Then I would like to conclude this very brief overview by mentioning a recent controversy that has been opened by David Hockney. David Hockney is a very interesting British artist. He's very interesting by his own work, and he's also very interesting because of the good feeling and the nice explanations he can provide about the work of Picasso. Actually, he has understood very well how Picasso has been working and working around the classical rules of perspective, and he's doing it himself. And he is really, when you see his work, he has always exploded the notions of time and the notions of space. And recently, he has made a shock by finding out that most great art in the past had been actually developed using camera obscura. Camera obscura was a tool developed by artists at the time of the Renaissance, by Durer and many others, which was allowing them to project on a canvas or on a piece of glass the views that they had, and they were developing that to actually understand and practice perspective. And at some point now, a case is being made that almost all artists have been using camera obscura, and all the ones that were supposed to be very insightful and very talented and had a perfect control of their vision and of their workmanship were actually working like a photographer. I cannot believe that this was true personally. And I have used camera obscura and what is called also camera lucida. And there is such a long way between being able to do a nice piece of art and having an outline projected on a surface that it seems to me impossible to believe that this is true. But what is interesting is not what I think about it. What is interesting is that there is a huge discussion that happened in the art world on this controversy. And one of the targets of the controversy is actually Vermeer. And there has been a book and there are shows in museums which try to study this area. And the controversy is that, is it art if technology is being included, if artist is using technology? And of course, what is interesting is that the controversy starting by David Hockney. David Hockney is known to actually work to produce his art with fax machines, for instance, and he thinks it's a very valuable way of producing art. And now a lot of writers seem to decide that it's totally okay for artists to use whatever they want, including technology, including camera obscura or lucida. And my own conclusion is also it's totally valid to use computers. So this is a little plug for the end of this chapter on art and history. And now I'm going to talk briefly about the show. And I'm going to talk also briefly about my own work. So this is the artist. And the drawings are by Saul Steinberg. And about the show, we are showing upstairs a series of drawings, which are now part of the KITP collection. And the show is temporary, but I think those pieces will be installed once the extension of the KITP is done with. And in addition to those drawings, there are a number of prints which are upstairs and some drawings which I have loaned to the show. I want to talk briefly about the prints. The prints are a series of 24 prints, which are a subset of a series of 102 prints. And these are actually work done with essentially geometry. The drawings are made with a starting point in geometry, but I will explain on some examples that beyond geometry, I have tried to shape the world that I'm showing by using mathematics and by using fields which actually create light, create shadows, create motion. What I'm going to say now will accompany a series of slides. I first want to make a brief statement of how I've been working and why I've been working along those lines. I feel really at home here with theoretical physics because I have tried to make art in a theoretical way myself. And this is why I agreed with David when he was asking if I was thinking of myself as a conceptual artist, and I think I do. And when we think of conceptual artist in some way, you don't expect to see art. You expect to read a piece of paper that will explain what the concept is, and I have seen that often at the Museum of Modern Art. You can see pinned on the wall a little, you know, letter where the artist explained what he would do if he was not doing conceptual art, and this is all you have. And in a way, I've been doing that, but at the same time, I've been doing that with the ultimate intent to actually make art and to produce a drawing. And my intent to do that was actually my very deep love for drawing. I've been growing up in France, and I spent a considerable amount of time in art galleries and in museums. My favorite place was Pavillon de Flore at the Louvre, where all the drawing exhibits happen. And I have a very deep relationship with drawing of the French school, of the Italian school. And having a total admiration for those artists who have done that, although I was drawing and painting myself, it seemed like a very discouraging activity, which was bound to failure if I was not really trying to find a way to work better. And actually, when I started understanding the power of programming, the power of computers, I decided I should try to do something for it about drawing. So this is really how I started. And my idea was to make drawing mostly a mental activity where I would not be the victim of my own muscles, of my own weaknesses, of my own body, but where I could just follow my brain and try to learn and develop my understanding of it. So this is why I have tried to ban the physical side of drawing. And I used devices to actually produce the physical proof of the concept that I was developing. And interestingly, I have seen recently that there has been a kind of minimalization going on progressively in drawing, where artists were claiming that they were, you know, at the time of Jackson Pollock, they were using their whole body to make drawings. And there are films of Jackson Pollock with really dancing in front of canvas with brushes, and he exert a very, very forceful activity of his own entire body. And then a number of artists decided that they should use less and less of their body. So they started to use only their arms, starting at the shoulder, and then some others wanting to make their drawing just starting at the elbow, and then some others just using their hands, and then some others just using the tip of their fingers. I have an artist friend in New York who does incredible drawings, which in a way look like mine, but he's doing it by hand. And he claims that he's just doing, you know, that with the last tip of his fingers. And actually, a long time ago, I decided I should not use my body at all. So this is, you know, a definition of how I work. And something which I want to say also is that doing drawings like that, actually I feel that I am almost like a composer or a choreographer, and I compose a score, and the score is being played by a device instead of being played by interpreters, but the process is really the same. So now we're going to see a lot of images. I'm looking at the clock with anguish because I have many slides to show you from now on. And anybody can stop me when this is, you know, going far enough. So this is the first piece I did in something like 1978. And this is my tumor and tumor. This is my tumor and tumor, which was probably in something like 84. And there is prior art and intent in what I am doing. And actually, writings by Peter Mondrian and by Max Beal in 38 and by Vasily Kandinsky theorized about the incorporation of mathematics and logic and numbers. At some point, Kandinsky said that any piece of art should actually just result of a string of numbers. And then other people in the 40s, like Hans Interreiter, started to dream of a machine that would help them do their work. And actually, Jean Tinguely, who is actually here, built such machines from junk. And he was a genial sculptor. I think he's Belgian. And he did wonderful machines, including some machines that were making drawings. And to show that somebody who is undoubtedly an artist, Marcel Duchamp, approved of it, Marcel Duchamp is actually using that machine to make a drawing. And then computer came in, and I have certainly a great number of names to drop there. An interesting artist was Larry Kuba, who actually used computers to do film animations, and has done very interesting work. Just when I started, beating me by a few months, there was Manfred Mohr, who is a German artist who lives now in New York, who actually did a complete series of cubes that were created on computers. Interestingly, he has been sticking with cubes forever. He switches his cube style every year or so, but he's really a conceptual artist, and he's using computers but other means, and this is something that I can understand. There is also Hans Dellinger in Germany, and I have a sculptor friend to name here, who is Elaman Ferguson. Elaman Ferguson is also using computer to actually devise the concept of a very beautiful sculpture, which he after that render in bronze, in marble, in granite, and is part of this kind of effort. So here, this is a drawing I did a number of years ago. There is a missing part here, and there is a missing part there. And in the first occurrence, I was throwing these away, but now I like them because they are really faithful to the process. Here, I'm using a way to generate this image, which consists of drawing a unique line which is going to sweep all across this section of the plane. And the line is swept by a pen, and here the pen refused to start, there was no ink. And here the ink started to dry, and there is nothing at the end. So it's really, really accommodating the reality of what I was going to do. And sometime, only once, there was a miracle. There was ink, the full ink stream was coming there, and then it slowly dried up, and then I still ended up with something, so I have a complete figure, but it was a failure all over. And this is my favorite piece. But when everything goes well, this is a kind of line which I try to have on paper. This is a huge blow-up of a small detail in the center of a piece on paper. And this is very hard to see, but here you can see very pale lines which are coming across, and here you have a much higher density. this is how most of my drawings are done. It's just by varying the density of lines over the surface of the paper. And on this and the following drawings I'm going to see, I was experimenting with something that I should work again, which was actually to simulate gravity. I was throwing lines into a field of gravity that was populated by a number of spheres which had their own weight, their own masses. And this is how the lines were shaped. They were shaped by attractions and repulsions. So this is one of the species. And you can see, you can see here the elementary lines. They are far apart, but here you can see a very intense red because there is so much ink on the paper that it's totally absorbed and the paper is kind of wrecked. That's another one. It's the center of another one. And this is playing with something that has fascinated me when I was starting to work on that, which was the concept of fractals and plane covering patterns. I read that in someone that has been very important for me, with a mathematician coming from Poland and lived in France and in the United States. It's Benoit Mandelbrot. Benoit Mandelbrot is very well known for the Mandelbrot set, but to me, much more interesting have been all his revelations of the fractal nature of the fractal geometry of nature. And the fractal geometry, which actually center on self-similarity, which I have used in many ways in my work. And here we have a rectangular grid, which is covered by splines, which are the soft curves that actually, you know, cut corners to actually cover the entire thing. And next, we have something which was really interesting to me when it first happened. I did a piece with a pen and paper driven on the plotter, and this is a blue line which is here. And after doing that, I made a reduced version of the same logic of plane filling and used a brush instead. And interestingly, I discovered that the brush is cutting corners too, like a mathematical spline. And instead of making those nice 90 degree or so angles, and there is some flexibility in the brush, and it by itself make all those very nice, interesting things. So next, that's a plotter. You see how it moves. The pen moves in one X and the paper moves in Y. By combining the two, you can draw something. Here on the plotter, I have installed a brush and you see a little hazy wire. And actually this is a Teflon tube, which is sending paint to the brush because obviously Hewlett-Packard never intended their plotters to be used that way. So I have to manufacture many little contraptions of the kind. This is painting by hand over computer made drawing. This is part of a series of work which I did maybe 5 or 6 years ago of about 40 pieces which are very small, and I hope somebody will photograph them someday. And what happened there is an accident, but the whole series was meant to follow the work of an artist I love, with Agnès Martin. Agnès Martin has done a lot of work with very fine and intelligent pattern of grids that are done either with graphite or with ink or with brushes. And I've done the same thing, but then I have entered those grids in my pattern of field warping. And this is where you see all those little bumps and you see all those little details. And what happened here is that I made a blue layer, and then when I started the brown layer, then there was a big stain of ink, and the plotter blindly went over it and the ink stopped flowing and started again. And sometimes those accidents are very annoying, but sometimes I like them, and this is what I like. And this is also another big stain. This was a piece that was actually, like many of my work, going out of a spiral that goes around and which I shape with a field. And there was again a stain of ink that fell from the pen. And every time the pen tip was coming, it was, you know, taking ink with it in a kind of abnormal way. This is something which I have not done in many years, but it's a silver point. Actually, instead of using graphite lead on the plotter, I have prepared the paper as Dürer and other artists were doing in Renaissance, and I used the tip of a little silver steel. And the paper being prepared as a little tooth, so it can take a little silver out of the rod, and then it takes, with oxygen, it takes a very nice darker color, and it makes a very nice drawing without any contemporary tools. This is actually a simple drawing transferred with a computer-driven router on a board of maple. And this is done on a piece of wood. This is a fractal. And having done that a number of times, I met, oh no, this is the same thing done in aluminum. And then what I did, I pressed it against paper and I did embossing. And next, I took a block of maple to Richard Tully's atelier in town. And he has this huge hydraulic presses, and he's making handmade paper. So we took a sheet of paper, and we just tried to emboss it with a board of maple. The board of maple was about one inch thick when we started. But the pressure was so huge that at the end, it was half an inch thick, and the paper was marked. And interestingly, you can see, I hope you can see, all the hard cells of the wood are still visible, are making lines. And interestingly, all those grooves had 90 degree angles before they went to press, and after just one press, they are about 135 degrees, and I cannot use them anymore. But embossing paper is fun. This is a solar plate, which I did with Hélène Levasseur and all our friends at Adulted. This was actually a pattern that really looks like the first one I showed you that I had done in something like 78 with a plotter. And it's a pattern that I later discovered had been actually done by Annie Habers, the wife of Joseph Habers. And it's little squares with random combinations of part of triangles. And it assembles very nicely. I printed that on a laser printer on transparency, and then in our class, we just exposed a solar plate to the sun and washed it with water, and we ended up with etching the plate, which then can be used on an etching press. And this is the same thing, but here the pattern was actually a cellular automaton, like what the ones that have been developed by Stephen Wolfram, who has also done Mathematica. And a cellular automaton is a kind of a self-organizing organism which finds its own way of growth. And in order to do that, you just provide a way of growth, and then it will just expand itself and take you somewhere. This is also a small etching, and it was done also on a solar plate. It's done with colors. And it follows the spiral series that you can see in the show upstairs, but that piece is not part of it. This is actually a scan of an Islamic tiling. And I wrote some software to transfer the grayscales of that image into lines. And here you can see the lines. There is one here, and one there, and one there, and one there. And between the lines, there is white paper. So this is generally light. Here, the lines are slightly covering themselves, so it's much darker. Here it's even darker, and it's really dark. But by spacing lines, it's possible to make grayscales. This is another cellular automaton, and this was a result of a collaboration with an artist friend in Los Angeles, Victor Raphael. This was shown not too long ago at the Carpelles Gallery, and the little cellular automaton is about, you know, 1 inch square, and there are little spots of gold leaf which have been laid by Victor Raphael. And this is another collaboration with a friend who is now in Bulgaria but was living in Santa Barbara and was actually teaching composition in the music department at Anas Lolov, and we did that by spinning tops, having put a little bit of graphite where they spin. And this is another one with colors. And here, that's something I did last year. This is a kind of automatic Jackson Pollock. We built a large structure with a pendulum, and we swung the pendulum, dripping different kind of acrylic inks. And it's very interesting that when they fall, you can see the initial conditions of the drops by looking at the direction in which they are imprinted on paper. Here the motion is much slower, it's very fast, so you can check all of that by sizing the different drops. And this is a piece done on sand, because when you have the concept of a drawing, you can make it on paper and using different tools, but then you can also make it on glass, on wood. I have done some on steel with a plasma torch. Unfortunately, I don't own one, so I did that only once. And it's much easier to deal with sand. And actually, once we had shown this image or a similar one to one of our neighbors, and she asked us, "Are you doing that at the beach?" And I said, "No, we're doing that in a different way." And what I do is actually add a ball being guided by a magnet. The magnet runs under a table. The table is covered with sand. The magnet is commanded by motors. The motors are driven by computers. And as the ball rolls through the sand, it can make a very interesting and accurate drawing. And it's very simple. And this is how it works. There is a drawing which is done, and this is the hand of Claire, my wife. She's going to take the ball from the center, and then she's going to do something which is very zen. She's going to wipe out the previous pattern, and then she's going to take a brush, and all traces of what had happened before will disappear. And the drawing being dead can be started again. Here we are finding where the magnet is, putting a ball, and then we can go to the next one. So each piece, instead of trying to be as durable as possible, is meant to be ephemeral, and there is some interesting beauty in that. And I think I have some more. So this is, the ball is actually captured at maybe 5 minutes interval there. This was the first device that was built, and it was very slow, and actually this took almost an entire day. And you could see that, if I run it again, that this is the morning light from, you know, coming from the west. And then you will see that the sun is turning, and the light will become warmer. And then the light will, here's the sun, and now the sun disappeared, and now it's electric light. And also, you're not forced to destroy the piece when it's done. You can light it, and you can have it stay there and look at it, and it makes very nice shadows and takes the light very beautifully. And you can rake the sand like a good Zen monk in a gravel garden in Kyoto. And we have a Japanese basket to go with that. I'm sorry, I didn't intend to do that again. But here it is. Well, this is another drawing. Instead of having one of the very simple lines which I generally use, this is a massive array of random patterns which are all programmed also, and they are all warped with waves. And these are intriguing things which are actually able to cover the planes too, and they are spiral tilings. They are very interesting shapes which you would not think would actually be able to make spirals or cover the plane, but actually they do. And making those spirals reminds me of a discussion I had with Everard not too long ago, who I will show his work again, his work in physics, but he gave me some very new insight on how spirals are made. This is actually an interesting figure that anybody can do. If you make concentric circles, you draw a concentric circle on a sheet of paper, and then you cut the paper just through the center, you can then actually have a translation of the two sheets in relation to each other. And every time you will actually translate by the interval separating the two consecutive circles, you will have a shift of phase, and you will actually create spirals with a great number of arms. And this is found also in experiments in physics. Well, I started with a very typical Islamic tiling, and then I threw it through my kind of time machine for warping, and actually it was spiraled considerably. And here I'm doing the same thing to Picasso. Picasso has done that to a lot of things, and I'm doing that to him. And this is Mondrian again. Here you see the red line is actually the central part of the theme, which is illustrated in the series of 102 prints, which is upstairs, the first 24 of them, which I had nicknamed the Metagon. The Metagon is this succession of part of a triangle followed by part of a square and a part of a pentagon and part of an hexagon and ad libitum. And here I used each vertex to move a black bar and created a coloring wool. And And then when you run that, you can create as many Mondrians as you want. Then you can, you know, do this process in any way. The next image is very different. The next image is the only remnant of works that I have done for several years. Part of it being to pay bills. And this is using voxels rendering. Actually, what you see there, you have recognized the core of an apple, but you see around the core things that you are not used to see. And actually, the apple has been processed by MRI microscopy at Duke Radiology by the team of Alan Johnson. And with that, I had a data set which, using software used for oil exploration and used for medical imaging, allowed me to actually look into the data and render it and organize it with lights and so forth. But I had this software to actually make a series of animations for medical education. But having that software at home, I could do a very wonderful thing. Unfortunately, they are all lost. They are all lost for two reasons. The result I actually stored on a very expensive laser disc by Sony. And that disc is now obsolete. And before dying, actually, it actually completely mangled all the recordings that I had done of very beautiful animations. And then the software I was using was on a normal hard drive, and the hard drive was 50 gigabytes, and everything died. And I tried to have it restored, but nothing came out of it. And at the time, all of this disk equipment was so expensive that I had no backup. So I have lost a lot of software that I had written and very interesting work. And it shows at the same time how dangerous it is to have data on computers. Unfortunately, almost all our civilizations now is running on computers. And everybody can do that. and everybody can lose a lot of work. So this is something else which I did, which was a little bit of fun. In the 16th, 17th, 18th century, people liked to do anamorphosis. And they were actually distorting images, like this one is, or this one, so that the reflection in something that was either cylindrical or conical or spherical or whatever would look like something. And actually, people were doing that to avoid censorship, political or otherwise. And this is something different. This is work that I have done for fun. It's actually based on the Rorschach test when you do ink blots and look at them and try to guess what they are. And I wrote a little bit of software to do that. And using that, I can actually split images in vertical bands and vertical bands. And each band I mirror here and there. I mirror here and there. I mirror here and there. And I juxtapose them. And actually, what you're looking at here is a herd of zebra at a watering hole. And this is a photograph that I made of crumpled paper that I hold in the sun. And I was very happy to see this little man with a hard hat here. And actually, this is done with sunspots. And it's really based on symmetries, and symmetries are important in nature. And this is Europa. Europa is one of those neighbors that NASA is exploring, and you can see it spinning here. And it has a very interesting surface, and I don't really know how the surface is made, but it comes with very interesting features. And if I apply my symmetry rules, I can create all kind of little interesting stories that our brain will recognize even if our intelligence doesn't. What is interesting is that if we're holding that not horizontally but vertically, our brain won't see anything anymore. But here we see eyes and noses and insects and dinosaurs and whatever. And that's what you saw before the talk started. And this is also Europa, and here it's slowly turning. And all those interesting random lines are the basis of what is happening here. But we won't go through that again. These are patterns which have been created by very simple functions in two dimensions. And they create grayscale. Here you have white, and you have black, and you have gray. And if the functions are periodic, you can create interesting things. You can combine them. I've done a lot of work like that. This is done with just one line of Mathematica, actually. It's just one simple formula. So here is our metagon again. And we found it in very interesting places. For instance, we recognize that a number of stars in the North American nebula was actually really drawing exactly the start of the metagon. And this is our last bûche de Noël. And this is something that really looks like what I had shown earlier in art coming from physics. Here we have all those bull eyes, and here we have all those little packs of spirals, which are really following those experiments that takes place next door in the physics department here. This is something else. Everybody has heard about evolution and genetics, and there is something called genetic programming. In genetic programming, the evolution is actually handled by software. So you create a genome. The genome contains a certain number of parameters, and you can actually evolve the genome and look at the result at each generation. At each generation, you can choose what is best, what you like, what you don't like, and you pick those individuals to actually create the next generation. And I created a number of interesting things doing that, but then I stopped doing it because I really felt I had really nothing much to do about it, that it was really found. So I have stopped doing genetic art. these are experiments I did earlier this year, and it consists of making plates in different technical ways dealing with printmaking. And I did all those plates with actually my sand tray, removing sand and replacing it by copper and whatever was needed to do that. Speaking about ephemeral art, I tried something which still really interests me, which is to do art with water. So these are little bubbles of water. They are all above paper by capillarity and surface tension. And you can actually do quite a bit of that and make complex arrays like that. And I could also, I have not done it yet, use a computer to actually put all those drops of water on paper, and you can light them, you can look at them, and then they evaporate. 20 minutes later, there is nothing left, which is really interesting. Water is very important in all you know, the deformation and warps that I have applied to my very basic and simple lines. I think that very often I'm using equations which really come from fluid mechanics, although they don't. But looking at what happens, I see all those wavelets and all those caustics, and it really looks like a lot of things that I have been doing. And what I've been doing is also trying to study it, and often I've been hanging on, around at the harbor, taking images of the reflection of a yacht mast in the water, and extracting those very interesting curves, or these very interesting curves. But then I just collect them, and I have nothing, I've done nothing with them yet. This is what I do, and I think this is about the end of the talk. And references, links, and bibliographies will be posted within a week on the KITP website, and thank you very much. If anybody has questions, I'd be very happy to answer.
So, Jean-Pierre is happy to take questions after that incredible introduction. A few questions.
Tell us about flatics work.
How does the mathematics of it work?
The question was how. Explain the mathematics of
that. Oh, there are many mathematics. There are many ways to handle mathematics to do drawings. Actually, it generally starts by doing lines, and it starts with geometry. So a line is something that you can say will go from here to there. So if you define these two points, and if you say that you're drawing a line from here to there, you're doing mathematics. But then what I do very often is, instead of just going from here to there, I decide that I will draw many little segments instead of a big line. And then I apply some kind of a rule to make those little segments alive, and alive in a different way. So I can establish a rule that will, according to the rank of the segments in the sequence or according to its position in the plane, I will move it differently. And by moving it in certain ways, I can animate what was a very dull straight line into something that follows a rule. And if I do that for many lines next to each other, then I can build very, very nice shapes. And if I have some understanding of how this works, not because I am smart, but because I'm trying and trying again till the day I have a result which pleases me, then I keep the rule and decide that this is what I will do, and I can then, you know, create a whole set of it. And instead of doing a very small drawing, I can prepare the trajectory for a pencil to cover a huge sheet of paper and make something that I would never have been able to do otherwise. So it's very simple mathematics. I'm using sine and cosine and additions and divisions. And sometimes I'm doing things that are smarter than that, but it's not necessary. You can do very beautiful things with very simple rules. This is what happens with cellular automatons. This is what happens with fractals. What is important is to have a rule and to apply it blindingly. And you have to trust it, and you have to apply it, and apply it, and apply it. And very often, something very nice will come out of it.
So it's trial and error.
How large is the computer that you use now? Do you try to keep up with the latest big machines, or are you still using small ones?
I try to have big, fast machines, although they are not at all necessary. When I started doing that, I had machines with something like 16 or 32K of RAM and no graphics screen, and I could only use Fortran, and there was no editor, and everything was a pain. But at the same time, I could still do geometry with them, and I could actually produce data sets, which I could send to plotters so that I could at last see what I had done. Now, of course, I can have very huge space, and I can have very complex rules, and I have very good graphic screens, so I can actually test what I want to do, and I can choose between this and that, which I could not do before. And what is important also is that past the point where I have created something, I spent a lot of time actually documenting it and photographing it and duplicating it and putting it on a website. And for all those ancillary activities, the best, your computer, the best, you know, there is no doubt. But it's not needed to actually do art. You can do that with a very small machine.
One thing you should note that maybe some of you missed, when he started doing this, the computers were so crummy that he couldn't visualize what would come out until it went into one of these fancy machines. So it all went in there until the last day.
Mm-hmm.
You had a thing. So now, of course, you can see it immediately.
Yes, yes.
The question I have to you is, you know, do you think you would have gotten as far as you did if you hadn't had this early hard stage?
Certainly
so you
not.
To conceptualize
Certainly them? Not. And that's one of the problems now of using computers, which is that there are so many facilities which are offered to people that they are actually becoming lazy and they don't really think hard and they don't try to discover the hard rules of the game. So using actually Illustrator and Photoshop seems to be an easy solution, but what I find is that it takes people nowhere, and if it takes them somewhere, it's always the same place because they only have the same menus and the same buttons to push on. So their work is actually commoditized and it's not personal. So I think that using one's own tool is certainly the best thing to do. And it's actually easy. Now it's easy to program. You can program not using C++ and Fortran and so forth, but you can use, for instance, shell language like Python or Tickle or Perl. And those do not need compilation. You can write them with a very simple editor. Computers are so fast that you can have a matrix of lines and points in minutes. So you don't need a lot, and it's not difficult. It's much better than buying expensive commercial software to do the same thing that everybody else is doing.
Has changed as computers have perfected, and nowadays the mathematical formula the plotters you are using are much more exact. You find yourself more interested with the pure mathematical formulas.
No.
No. You still look for the randomness of nature to introduce itself.
I really look for that. I think that. I'm not really interested, for instance, although I would love KITP to have a plasma screen to display images that we could enjoy and change and animate. I'm not really interested in being wired to look at art. I think art should be in bronze or on paper or in wood or anything that is alive and is part of our own world. So I think that the more in our world, the best. And I've always tried to do my work. At the time, it was the only tools that were available, like those plotters that I've been using. But it's much more interesting if it comes with all its defects, if you can see with your eyes how ink comes on paper, how an etching line is actually marked into the paper. It's much more interesting that having a very light spray of ink coming from a digital printer. So even to this day, I barely use digital printers, but for this series. And the series which is upstairs, I really like, because it really, when it was done, it has really pushed the envelopes of printing. It had been printed in Vermont by John Cohn, and John Cohn was a professional printer. Before going to digital, he was making plate prints in New York with famous artists, with Sol LeWitt, etc. And then he became sick because of the chemicals. So he went digital. And when he invited me to his studio to make those pieces, he really had the reputation to be the best. And what really surprised me when I came there, he had never ever printed anything that was as demanding as what I was asking him to do. And so I went through those prints just because of the exquisite, what I find exquisite, quality of the printing that they provide, because the density of lines was computed mathematically, so you have very smooth and nice transitions. You have colors which just vanishes into the paper. You don't even know where they start and where they end. And if you try to do that with nowadays printers, it's just totally not interesting. So I wanted those digital prints to either be perfect, but it's very difficult to have them perfect because now those printers are getting obsolete. The only good digital prints that have been made are made with iris printers, and they are not made anymore. It's like plotters. So I like plotters, but they are not manufactured anymore. So now everybody is stuck with computers and Epson printers, and it's very difficult to do a nice output unless you go personal, trying to etch plates and trying to buy on eBay an old plotter and fitting a brush on it and forgetting actually about technology because it's not good enough for art, and just working with your brains on concepts.
In some of the examples you showed, there were true accidents in which the ink pen messed up and created an interesting effect. But in some of your art, it looks to me as if you've deliberately introduced random accidents in the formulas themselves. So is that correct? Did you do that?
Yes, exactly. I introduced that, for instance, by introducing mathematical discontinuities, which actually simulate cracks and tears in the paper and in the lines. And well, I do that because I find it interesting. But I do it on purpose, yes.
Let's thank Jean-Pierre again. And I remind you that there are drawings and computer simulations upstairs. If you haven't yet seen them, please take the opportunity to do so. And the refreshments and